Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State, providing access to the most advanced cancer treatments available from a team specialized in treating just one type of cancer, yours. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/choosethejames.
Welcome to the All Sides Reporter Roundtable, an hour-away catch-up on the political news of last week and preview the week ahead. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Joining me on the roundtable today, we have Joe Ingles, senior reporter for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Welcome back, Joe.
Great to be here.
Laura Hancock, politics and policy reporter at Cleveland.com. Welcome back, Laura.
Hello.
And Megan Henry, a reporter with the Ohio Capital Journal. Welcome back, Megan.
Good morning.
And lawmakers are not back in session quite yet, even though it is after Labor Day, but they'll be returning soon. Do we have any idea? Is there anything on the calendar of when exactly lawmakers will be back at the State House full time?
No.
No.
Not yet. But okay. But we do expect them back. I mean, I think they're talking. You can tell when you interview them and talk to them that they're talking, you know, to each other, kind of, you know, getting the footprint set of where they want to go.
Mm-hmm. Have you heard any rumblings about what the main focus will be when they get back? Like, what's the first thing out the gate?
Well, I think they have to take up redistricting. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's going to be something they're going to have to look at by law. Mm-hmm. So
that'll be the first thing on the agenda. You have any, Megan?
I also think property taxes. There's been lots of chatter about that this year, so I think that'll be a big thing that the lawmakers will be tackling this year.
And doesn't the Senate have a veto override to consider? They haven't done that yet. The House did one tiny one, right?
Yeah.
Yep. So sometime this month.
Redistricting this month, I would expect next month.
I think, yeah, session is scheduled for October, so they have to be back
right
by then, the latest.
Okay. Well, the big thing that happened in Columbus over the long weekend was not politics per se, but it was the Ohio State football game, beating number one ranked Texas in the home opener. And politics, even though it's not fully at play, it was at play during the game. I saw lots of photos with lots of people there. Governor DeWine and Lieutenant Governor Jim Tressel were there with the U.S. Housing and Urban Development Secretary, the HUD Secretary, Scott Turner. Governor Hopeful Vivek Ramaswamy was there, and he was greeting fans, young and old alike. I saw Republican U.S. Senator John Husted, lots of people. One thing that I did see, though, is Dr. Amy Acton, a Democratic hopeful for governor, she used her social media last week to kind of like tie Texas to Vivek Ramaswamy. Her challenger moved his business operations from here to Texas. This is an older story, but she was using the Texas game to bring it up. Megan, do you remember why he moved his company to Texas or when that was?
It's been a few years, I believe. I'm a little fuzzy on some of the details.
Joe, do you remember?
He sold it, didn't he? I think he sold, or, you know, I believe he sold it, and or spinoff part of it. I'm fuzzy as well, but I think there was something like that, and then, you know, it went to Texas, but I can't really remember.
It was between him running for president and before he announced he was running for governor. So
something like that.
Yeah, we'll look into that. But yeah, Dr. Amy Acton was using the Ohio State-Texas game to bring up any tie Vivek Ramaswamy has to Texas, saying that he was actually cheering for Texas, not Ohio State. So, Megan, I know you enjoyed the game. What did you make of the politics at play on the field?
It was basically like a who's who of who's all there. I mean, it was obviously the home opener, the season opener, and this is the biggest game of the week and probably one of the bigger home season openers, period, in history. Mm-hmm. So it makes sense that it brought a whole bunch of politicians.
Yes, and I do know that I think the HUD secretary is from Texas, so I'm not sure exactly what shirt he was wearing and who he was cheering for, but he was definitely there.
Hopefully the winning team.
All right, this is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we are talking this week about all things Ohio politics with a special Tuesday edition of the Reporter Roundtable with Joe Ingles from the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, Megan Henry with the Ohio Capital Journal, and Laura Hancock from Cleveland.com. So given that it is back to school time, I wanted to get into some education-related news. Joe, your colleague Karen Kassler had a story about a new AI policy. This was tucked into the enormous budget bill that was passed passed recently, and it does not require schools to teach AI, but it wants all K-12 schools to have an AI policy. Here is Chris Woolard, the Chief Integration Officer for the Ohio Department of Education and Workforce, explaining it.
You got to have some guardrails in place, but at the same time, you want to encourage innovation, but there's so many different considerations. So having some sort of policies are going to be critical.
All right. So, Joe, they want K-12 schools to at least have an AI policy. Acknowledge it exists.
Yeah. They want the schools to come up with their own AI policy and sort of police how it's being used. They want to make sure that students know how to use it for, you know, scholarly purposes, that they understand how to actually use AI and discriminate what they see on it, you know, AI, because we all know that AI is often wrong. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so they want students to develop those skills, but they want guardrails. They want the schools to put in place different rules that make sense for their students. And so they're not saying, okay, here's how you have to do it, but they're saying, here's what we want you to do. They did this with the cell phone policy to begin with, actually.
Well, and I'm also, I think I read in Karen's story that Ohio is the first state in the nation to make K-12 schools do this.
It is a first state in the nation to do that. But I really don't think this is a huge, honestly, a lot of schools are already doing this. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of schools have already looked at this. So it's not like you're springing something on schools that they're not already thinking about. It's not out of the blue.
And Megan, you wrote that higher ed is ahead of the curve on this move too. There's colleges and universities are leaning into AI.
Yes, Ohio State just launched an AI initiative. The goal is for students to be bilingual in AI, meaning that they know how to incorporate AI in their respective field of study. And while Ohio State is kind of the first in Ohio higher ed to have such a policy implementation, other universities such as Ohio University are implementing AI-related courses so that they can teach students how to use it in their field. I talked to some professors in the College of Business about how they're incorporating that more so into their MBA program. Mm,
yeah, and I also read some professors who maybe are not so keen on AI are even talking about bringing back. Did you read that they're talking about bringing back the blue books? Do you know what the blue books are?
I know what they are. Yes, so not a bad idea.
For people who don't know, the blue book is where you write down longhand by hand your answer to a question, because that way you can't cheat with AI if you're sitting in the room writing the answer down.
Right. Exactly.
Last year, then Governor Husted came out with this thing called the AI Toolkit with some industry partners, and it was like optional for public schools to use. But it was kind of like discussing the ethical implications, like plagiarism and taking somebody's work without crediting them. And then as well as just kind of like pull out your device, your phone, and let's look up a few things and figure out, you know, which ones are wrong and which ones are right, to really kind of, you know, hone in for kids' AI and the potentials and the pitfalls. So I think this just sort of builds on that. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, moving more toward higher education, colleges and universities are continuing to comply with Senate Bill 1, the new law that overhauls higher education. Megan, you wrote a story about students' feelings, the effects of this new law. A photo that accompanied your story showed students at a march rallying against the bill. One of them is holding a sign that says, "Hey, Jerry, Senate Bill 1 gets an F." That's in reference to Jerry Serino, the bill's sponsor. So you talked with students at Ohio University, and one student in particular spoke about the Pride Center. Can you tell me about, did they have to close the Pride Center at Ohio University?
Yes, they did have to close the Pride Center at Ohio University. Across the state, public colleges and universities closed a lot of their diversity centers, such as their women's centers, LGBTQ or Pride Centers, and also multicultural institutions. So at Ohio University in particular, this student was saying how a big reason she came to Ohio University was because of the Pride Center, and she even had a job there for 3 years, and now she lost her job. She's a senior now and has to find a job on campus, and she actually helped empty out the Pride Center. And so she was telling me how she knows that it's no longer there, but she's having a hard time kind of processing the fact that it's gone.
And you spoke with a student from Kent State. They had an LGBTQ plus living learning community there. Did that also close?
Yes, the learning community center did close. The residence hall is still there and students can still live there, but the program itself is no longer there. And so I talked to a student who really benefited from that program, that programming they offered last year. And so just feeling the effects of all these changes on campuses.
And Laura, you and your colleagues at Cleveland.com wrote about concerns students are having regarding education policies related to the Trump administration, from everything that's taught in class to student loans to international students. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me a little bit about what you learned for this piece?
Well, if you start as an incoming freshman this year, you're going to have Trump as your president, assuming, you know, he's around for 4 years. And students talked to us about the Big Beautiful Bill and some of the changes that are being made in student loans, especially for graduate student loans. There'll be a lifetime ban of, I believe, around $100,000, which will make some professional programs such as like medical school like out of reach and force people into the private loan industry unless they can get like scholarships. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of concern about that. There were a lot of concerns. I did talk to some freshmen who were here last year when the DEI programs had to be closed and some of them were moved, like their missions were moved sort of to other, you know, offices on campus and broadened out to include everyone. And they just felt like it came out of nowhere because I think they're in college and not everybody in college is paying attention to the news. Mm-hmm. And they felt like, you know, the programs and services that were for, you know, the oppressed people are now including white people and men. And so they weren't so keen on that. Trump tried to throw out a bunch of college students who were like foreign students. They tried to revoke their visa, but like their legal status. And then they kept losing in court. So then the administration has pulled all that back and they're working on something else now. So we did talk to one student at Kent State University who's from Nepal. And he just told us that basically studying Medtronics. And he just told us that, you know, the United States used to be like this, you know, city on the hill, like the imagery that we were all taught in school. And he now thinks he'll just try to find a job in Europe when he's done, because mm-hmm. the United States is just changing and not for the best.
Mm. Yeah, I've heard a few stories here and there about fewer international students. We don't really have any numbers. We asked Ohio State for the numbers, but they don't have the actual numbers of who's here or who's not for the couple of weeks into school because they have to like figure that all out. So Joe, anecdotally, I mean, you do teach in higher ed, not full time, mm-hmm. obviously. This is your full time gig, but right. have you had any just as an adjunct professor, have you been impacted with any of this higher ed law in what you teach?
Well, I should preface this by saying I teach at Ohio Wesleyan University, which is a private mm-hmm. school, and it is not really affected by SB1, so at least not directly affected by SB1. So a lot of the things that, they're dealing with at these state schools that Megan and Laura are talking about, those are not something that the private schools have had to deal with. There's been an attempt, though, mm-hmm. to try to extend to private schools. But when you do that, you start running into a lot of issues, especially through religion, because a very large number of private schools are religious-based, have religious affiliations, and by having those, they also have protection for religious opportunities and that sort of thing. So I have not noticed a big difference in the number of students that I have in my two classes who are from other countries. I have probably the same number in my classes. I'm not sure. I think we're still kind of waiting. We just all started school, so people are moving, and you know, in our school the drop date was just last week when you could drop mm-hmm. and add classes, so you're still trying to shake out who's there, who's not, at this point I have not seen big changes.
Yeah, I guess I keep forgetting that the SB1, the higher ed law, is just public colleges and universities, because it seems so sweeping and we talk about it so often. But you are correct. It is not, yes.
One thing I have noticed, though, we were talking about students, you know, talking about going to Europe. I have some friends who live in various parts of Europe, and all of them have told me that they are there are parts of Europe where they are developing an anti-American kind of we don't want Americans coming here to visit. We're tired of you importing. You know, so in other, you know, that's something I know people travel to Europe, and I've asked people about that. And, they, you know, some of them have said, yeah, we've come up on that when we've been traveling. Other people say they haven't. But, you know, there are a lot of Americans, apparently, who are at least traveling for fun to Europe. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the numbers are. Of students.
It's definitely something to keep an eye on.
Right.
Another thing related to higher education that I wanted to touch on is that Ohio University in Athens last week announced that it will suspend future entry to 11 academic majors, and it's going to merge 18 other majors. So the move won't affect current students who are currently in the program. This is a future plan, but this is also to comply with Senate Bill 1, because Senate Bill 1 had a provision of if there weren't was it like 5 students in the major for X number of years, then they couldn't keep it?
Conferring at least 5 degrees for 3 consecutive years.
3 consecutive years, yeah. So that an example, they're eliminating their Bachelor of Arts in Chemistry and Bachelor of Arts in Mathematics, but they'll still offer Bachelors of Science in those fields. So I guess it's a nuanced thing, but they're definitely degree programs. And then they're going to merge 18 others. I have here a Bachelor's of Arts in African American Studies, a Bachelor of Arts in Religious Studies, a Bachelor of Arts in French. Some of these are all going to merge together. What do you make of this announcement of these changes for Ohio University, Megan?
I mean, with the rollout of this new bill, I guess it's not totally surprising. Mm-hmm. This is the second public Ohio University to do this. University of Toledo did this earlier in the summer as well. So this is kind of the second university to announce these cuts to these programs. I think I'm a little surprised to see this done so early, given that the law has just recently gone into effect. I think the idea, my understanding at least, was that, you know, this would kind of take some time. Those years that Laura was mentioning, I believe it was 3 years. So I think I was expected to see it more down the line, not like up front with the rollout of this bill.
Yeah, the American, the Professors Union, American Association of University Professors, AAUP, they have said that they don't think that this is right and proper, that you, year one is now. So then 3 years down the road is when you start looking at and eliminating programs. You don't start now and cut 3 years back because you can't have a law apply retroactively. However, both Toledo and OU are being very careful to make sure that no professors are laid off as they do this.
I mean, I guess maybe the move will help universities cut costs. So maybe having a Bachelor's of Arts and a Bachelor's of Science in the same for a school the size of Ohio University, maybe it makes sense to eliminate them. So this was an excuse. Is that the right word?
Probably, yeah.
You know, the thing about this, Amy, though, is this law, there's a whole lot of vagueness in it. And it leads, you know, in some places, like, the number of degrees conferred, that's not as vague. But there are other places in it where it's pretty vague and it's left to interpretation. And we have seen over and over in different, you know, in academia, in government, in business, when people don't have clearly defined spaces of what they can and cannot do, they tend to err on, you know, doing more than they might have to do ordinarily. Hmm. So, maybe the state lawmakers didn't intend for some of the things that are happening to happen. But when you write a law and it's vague and attorneys get involved, they say, oh, well, we don't want to run afoul of this. So, and we saw this when, the abortion law went into effect. If you want to go back to those days, we had the 6-week abortion ban in that summer. And, you know, the lawmakers were saying, well, we never intended for that to happen. But the thing was, the way the law was written and the way that the attorneys advise, oftentimes it goes the other direction. It goes too far. So we may be looking at a situation with some of the stuff that we're discussing this morning where there might be some sort of correction coming down the pike in a year or two if mm-hmm. there are problems that need it.
If one of the lawmakers maybe has a bachelor's of arts in chemistry, they might feel
that, or maybe it's affecting, you know, if it starts affecting, you know, students wanting to come to Ohio to get a degree because mm-hmm. they no longer feel like they can get, you know, something that they might want. And, you know, I can imagine that surrounding states, universities are probably going to say, hey, you know, you come here.
We have that degree.
Yeah. You have much more, you know, and especially when you start talking about the situation with the chalking on Ohio mm-hmm. State, which got so much attention. Their students are not allowed to. And I remember when I was in Ohio State, and that was ages ago, they've always written with chalk on the sidewalk, mm-hmm. different messages for rush or whatever. And Ohio State has banned students from being able to do that, ostensibly related to those.
You are already seeing Eastern Michigan University in Ypsilanti mm-hmm. is already marketing to Ohio students, like, you can be free to be yourself at Eastern Michigan University.
We'll give you chalk in your welcome packet. Well, not to be flippant, but, you know, Ohio State also has the Dispatch had a story that resident advisors were telling Ohio State students who live on campus to be careful about the type of decor they put up in common areas. They're only allowed to put up decor in student halls that promote student spirit. No posters that advertise cultural events or holidays, for example. And they're citing Senate Bill 1. But, Joe, could this be what you're talking about mm-hmm. an unintended consequence where
this
they're not allowed
exactly
to hang up a poster?
Yeah, well, I mean, what happens at Christmas time if students want to put... I remember we used to put all kinds of little Christmas things in our room around Christmas time. If students want to do that, that's a culture, right? Christmas. I mean, that's a religious culture.
So if we can put up a Christmas poster, why not a Ramadan poster? Right?
Exactly. Yeah. And where do those lines fall? And I think, you know, there's going to be some questions that are coming up. We're already seeing them. There will probably be more of them. And eventually lawmakers will have to come in and speak to those, I think.
All right. And I will note, they can decorate their rooms as they want. This is the common areas that we're talking
about. The common areas and the RA's rooms, too, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Coming up, we are going to talk about the idea to pay student teachers. And we're also going to talk about school vouchers and redistricting. That is when the Reporter Roundtable continues from all sides on 89.7 NPR News.
It's rare to find a podcast that can actually change your life. But when the show's called Life Kit, that's kind of the whole point. I'm Mariel Segarra. 3 times a week on the Life Kit podcast, we guide you through a topic we could all use help with, from personal development to healthy living to managing your dinero, with takeaways so you can start living what you learn right away. Escucha el Life Kit podcast from NPR.
This is All Sides and the weekly Reporter Roundtable. We're bringing you a special roundtable on a Tuesday here on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich. And with us in the studio, we have Laura Hancock, politics and policy reporter for Cleveland.com, Megan Henry, a reporter for the Ohio Capital Journal, and Joe Ingles, a senior reporter at the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. And I wanted to continue our education theme. There's lots of education things to talk about. Laura, you wrote a piece about a bipartisan plan to have student teachers be paid. Joe, you wrote about this topic as well. And here's some audio from Representative Sean Brennan, a former history teacher who put this idea forward.
Our bill is not mandatory. It simply allows districts to pay and to provide health care to student teachers as a way to incentivize young people to go into the profession.
So, Laura, let's start with you. Who's going to pay these teachers?
It would be the local school districts. Mm. There is no law saying that student teachers cannot be paid. Mm. So this would just be like if the legislature's stamp of approval is on it, they hope it incentivizes local school districts to start offering pay. They can't pay any more than minimum wage. The argument is that students have to pay tuition while they're student teaching because they are in school, and then they have to pay their living expenses, and then they're basically volunteering all this time at public schools, which is a full-time job. And for me, it was a little bit of a shock. I didn't realize they weren't being compensated. They say that if you're like an intern, most interns are paid these days. If you're an apprentice, apprentices are paid. So why can't student teachers be paid? And I also looked at other states. Michigan pays around $18,000 a year for student teaching. And this is all coming out of the central state fund. This isn't individual school districts. Michigan does, Pennsylvania pays, Oklahoma pays. I think it's just like $3,500 a year. Utah pays, I think it's around $5,000 a year. Colorado pays, I think, $20,000. So, yeah, so this helps. And then the Ohio bill has a thing that says that if the state wants, the Ohio Department of Education and Workforce can offer like a tuition waiver for their school expenses.
Okay. So, but basically you're saying that Ohio is leaning on school districts to say, hey, you should pay your student teachers, but Ohio's not saying they're going to pay for it.
No.
So there's the rub.
There's the rub. Yeah, because, you know, school districts right now, if you listen at what we hear at the State House, they're coming in telling us that they're, you know, down to the bone, and they really cannot figure out how to make ends meet with what they have. So the question is, you know, where do they come up with this money to pay student teachers if it's not coming out of a state fund?
Although the Ohio Association of School Boards did tell me that they supported the bill. So I have no idea what this is going to look like. Maybe it'll just be like minimum wage or something. But and we'll see. Some of the states that offer the pay, though, I just wanted to add, they require you to sign a thing that says, I'm going to teach for 3 years in this state, or I'm going to teach at high demand schools, you know, schools where they probably have a lot of turnover for teachers.
Okay. Well, so maybe some caveats if you're going to get paid. Yeah. Is it a bipartisan effort, though? So it seems like the bill it could happen.
Yeah, it's Sean Brennan is a Democrat from Parma in the Cleveland area. And then the co-sponsor is Don Jones, but he's now over at the U.S. Department of Agriculture under Donald Trump. But there also are these co-sponsors, a list of them, and there's like a ton of Republicans among the co-sponsors. So there is some.
So it sounds like a good idea to pay student teachers if they're making the district pay, so that because the state's not going to pay for it at this point. Right. Got it.
And it would allow, not mandate.
Encourage?
Encourage,
yes. All right. Well, another education-related story I wanted to get to is, Megan, you had a story that featured two families who send their children to private school. And you talked with them about their viewpoint on using vouchers. School vouchers are always a topic of a discussion, and it's been an increasing topic. But before you tell us what these two families had to say, just give us a little refresher on the near universal voucher program that we have going on right now.
Yeah. So back in 2023, the state budget expanded school vouchers in the state. I'm just pulling up the numbers to make sure I have it accurate. But yes, so basically, yeah, near universal vouchers for the state that folks can apply to. I believe it's 450% of the poverty line. You can still receive a scholarship. It's slightly more for high school students. I believe 8,000. If someone's double checked,
8,400.
8,400, and then 6,500. Yeah, for through K through 8 schools. So
people who are sending their kids to private schools can apply, and the state gives them money, and then they use that money toward the tuition.
Correct. Yes.
Okay. So what did you find out from these families who are sending their kids to private school? What's their viewpoint on using the vouchers?
Yeah, so definitely is controversial, the vouchers. And so one family sends their students to private school. They said it's really beneficial to their student and meets their students' needs. However, they are proponents of public schools and don't want to take money. In their view, they don't want to take money from public schools by using the vouchers. And so out of principle, they do not take the school vouchers for their student to go to a private school. On the other hand, this other family I talked to, the first family I was mentioning is in Columbus. The second family is up in Toledo, and they have three students, and two currently go to private schools. At one point, all three did. Kind of similar situation. This private school just met their family's needs more than the public school system allowed, and so they used the vouchers to help pay for their schools. And the mom I spoke to was saying how basically the vouchers allow her husband to not have to like work overtime and just basically allow them to help pay for their schools, their child's education.
Yeah. And Laura, you've been writing about vouchers too. For most of these, they don't fully pay all of the tuition for the private school, but it's a good chunk.
Yes. For the most part, they don't pay. But like, for instance, in Megan's story, the Columbus Jewish Day School was what, like 10,000?
It was nearly 20.
Yeah. Nearly 20,000 a year. So like, say like an eighth grader, that would be 6,500. So the parents are still going to have to come up with some money unless they get financial aid, that kind of thing. But then that particular family is not taking a voucher, so they're just paying the whole thing. So yeah, but most of the schools in the state do line up exactly with the voucher.
All right. And one other final school thing. I promise we'll move on from schools. But Megan, you also wrote about something that I had never heard of before, a micro school. Ohio has 30 of them. What is a micro school?
Yeah, this was a learning experience for me. I'd heard some chatter about micro schools kind of throughout the year. And so I thought it'd be worth looking into. Basically, it's these very small schools, as the name suggests. But their focus is on multi-age classrooms and more individualized learning experiences. It can really vary state by state. There, you know, the standards and the curriculum that's used. So it's very like up to the school, up to these very small schools to kind of decide how they want their curriculum to look like.
Are they private schools?
They can be private or public schools. It can vary.
Okay. So Ohio has 30 micro schools. Is it kind of like they're combining together like first graders and second graders are in the same class?
Correct. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. It's more popular with the younger grades, but it can include high school as well.
Okay. Is this a trend or is this just a thing?
It seems like it's been like a growing trend. I talked to someone who's with the National Micro Schooling Center, and he was explaining how it really took off during the COVID-19 pandemic. And coming out of the pandemic, some micro schools just kind of closed on their own kind of naturally, but some have continued, and there's been some increase in local demand. And so I think it's kind of a trend we're seeing.
Who knew? Yeah. All right. Micro schools. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about we're having the reporter roundtable, and we're talking about the latest in Ohio politics with Joe Ingles from Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, Megan Henry from the Ohio Capital Journal, and Laura Hancock from Cleveland.com. I wanted to move into redistricting because, as Joe mentioned at the top of the program, that is going to be a big topic of conversation when lawmakers do come back, either late September or sometime in October. They have to talk about it. And redistricting is making headlines in Texas and California. So Ohio is up next for new congressional maps. Last Friday, Missouri's governor ordered their state to redraw the U.S. House maps, expanding President Trump's push to tilt more seats toward Republicans in 2026. So, Joe, this process is happening after only 4 years after our last map. And so it's a quick turnaround. What is happening? Why are we redistricting right now?
Because the maps were not bipartisan. And therefore, if there's a whole process in place and if maps are passed on a bipartisan basis, it's a much easier path for those maps, and they can keep them in place. The lawmakers can keep them in place longer. But if there's not bipartisan agreement, then there's a series of steps that involves going before the redistricting commission and then certain things. And then the redistricting commission can pass the map, and then it doesn't have to be bipartisan when it comes out of the legislature. The second go, you know, and it right now, I mean, I think it really, it's kind of foretelling that we see indications already that, you know, lawmakers are not hopeful of any kind of bipartisan thing
on
coming out of it
side, yeah.
on the Democratic side. So I wonder if, you know, that's why we're not seeing dates set and we're not seeing like
so
real
no matter
action.
Yeah, no matter what map is drawn, the yeah. Democrats say yeah. the Democrats plan to disagree
so
with it.
So they may that first deadline that's there, they mm-hmm. may blow right through that thinking, well, we don't have any Democrats who are going to go for this. So why are we going to waste our time peddling on this bike?
Yeah, Laura.
Currently, we have 15 seats in the U.S. House of Representatives. 5 are Democratic held, and then 10 are Republican held. Some of those Democratic seats are kind of like very barely Democratic, you know, maybe 1-2% and can switch. And so you assume that the Republicans are going to, those are the districts they're going to target to try to make them more solidly red. And the thing is, okay, so like, you know, there's been all this focus on like California and Texas and in the national media. And then now they're talking Ohio. Ohio is going to happen, like Joe said, regardless. Mm-hmm. But now that there's all this national eyes on Ohio, I think the state Republicans will be under even more pressure to make it favorable for the Republican Party to try to deliver Donald Trump a midterm victory. Because if he gets a Democratic House or Senate, they can really stymie his plans.
J.D. Vance, the vice president, had a sit-down interview with USA Today last week, and he talked about redistricting and said that Democrats rigged the system. That was the quote he used. But given that Ohio Republicans have a lock on the state, I mean, this is a solidly red state, do they even need this pressure from J.D. Vance talking about these maps? I mean, aren't they going to be Republican-leaning maps?
Of course. Yeah. I think we can almost say, of course, they're going to be Republican.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, anyone who's betting is going to say that there will be more Republican seats that come out of whatever map comes out of the, you know, the whole process. And I know Senator Bernie Moreno was recently stating that he thought that, you know, you could get 2-3 more Republican seats out of Ohio. So I don't know. I mean, you know, we'll see how that goes. But you got to remember, Ohio already has a Republican supermajority. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of this has already been a lot of the things we're seeing happening in Texas. We've already seen shades of that, at least in Ohio.
And we have, like, in terms of courts, we have a state Supreme Court that is much more partisan than the last Supreme Court, because the last Supreme Court, the Chief Justice, who was a Republican, did mm-hmm. side with Democrats, mm-hmm. saying that the maps were illegal gerrymanders. Even despite those rulings, the legislature never complied with the court saying they were illegal. But that Chief Justice, Maureen O'Connor, is gone. And so now you have a Republican, and you only have one Democrat on the court now. So the, you know, the Supreme Court is highly likely to basically okay whatever the Republicans pass. And so then you just have to rely on the federal courts for rulings.
Will the Democrats in Ohio have any say over the maps? I mean, what pressure do they have?
They can just vote no, I think, just do lots of press conferences and try to draw the public's attention to it. I think they're already trying to, like, let people know, like, you need to come to these hearings and testify and let your voice be known.
But here's the thing. So few people understand gerrymandering. And, you know, when you go out, look at last year when they put gerrymandering or put the redistricting provision change on the ballot. Mm-hmm. The ballot board had Republican control, so they were able to force the language on that. They put the word gerrymandering in there. The language mm-hmm. was confusing. Voters said it was confusing. On both sides of the aisle, voters said it mm-hmm. was confusing. That goes up for a vote. Voters who already didn't feel confident in understanding the issue, then we're saying, okay, well, we're not sure about this. We're going to vote no. So it lost. And, you know, what control do the Democrats have that is going to be able to penetrate and get in there and change those minds? I mean, well, it remains to be seen what they can do.
We are going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about Ohio National Guard troops being in Washington, D.C. That is when the Reporter Roundtable continues from all sides on 89.7 NPR News.
It's rare to find a podcast that can actually change your life. But when the show's called Life Kit, that's kind of the whole point. I'm Mariel Segarra. 3 times a week on the Life Kit podcast, we guide you through a topic we could all use help with, from personal development to healthy living to managing your dinero, with takeaways so you can start living what you learn right away. Escucha el Life Kit podcast from NPR. You're listening to All Sides. This is the Reporter Roundtable on a Tuesday. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. With me in the studio, we have Laura Hancock, politics and policy reporter for Cleveland.com, Megan Henry with the Ohio Capital Journal, and Joe Ingles, senior reporter for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. I wanted to turn our attention to the Ohio National Guard, which is in Washington, D.C. Some retired military in the state are speaking out about Governor DeWine deploying the state's National Guard. One said that this is not a national emergency. And here is Navy pilot Ken Harbaugh, a former Democratic candidate for Congress in Northeast Ohio, and he is speaking out.
When they are pulled away from their families, when they have to miss birthdays and graduations and the beginnings of school and things like that to go guard a Shake Shack, I mean, put yourself in the shoes of that 20-something soldier who's being told that this is what you signed up for. It is gutting to the morale of the individual and the unit.
All right. So we're hearing criticism, but Governor DeWine defended his actions. Joe, what did Governor DeWine say as to why he sent the National Guard to D.C.?
Well, he said that there's been precedent to allow the National Guard to go in and do these kind of things. He says, President Trump asked for help, and actually his administration, not him personally, but his administration asked for help. And Governor DeWine points out that he said, okay, don't really handcuff our police by taking the National Guard members who are currently serving on police forces in Ohio. Don't take them out of there and make things more dangerous for our police or, you know, those kind of people in Ohio. So he says on a short-term basis, and this is a 30-day, this thing, the deployment is a 30-day long.
I meant to look up what day we're on. I don't even know how close we are to
that. We're kind of about halfway through it, aren't we?
Yeah.
I don't know. Feels like it.
Feels
like halfway through.
It feels like it's been 90 days, but yeah, okay, continue.
So, you know, he says all of those things. You know, he's allowing them to go forward because he thinks it's the right thing to do, but you know, let's put it this way. If this drags on and on, they go into more cities and there's more, you know, that could change the way Governor DeWine possibly reacts.
Laura, you brought our attention to a New York Times article that was out yesterday that wondered why Republican governors like Mike DeWine are sending National Guard units to D.C. and didn't deploy them in their own cities with high crime rates. So what did you learn from reading this story?
I learned that. I didn't know this, but Memphis apparently has a murder rate that's twice the size of Washington, D.C.'s. And the New York Times is relying on the FBI uniform statistics, crime statistics. And so this is, you know, readily available public information. It said that the crime rates in Dayton, Toledo, and Cleveland are just as high or higher, depending on the crime, as what they are in D.C. And then when they asked Governor DeWine's press secretary, Dan Tierney, why aren't you focusing on crime in your own state? Tierney just replied that the cities hadn't asked the governor for assistance, even though, and Trump had asked for assistance in D.C. So, but yeah, you're watching like Gavin Newsom is really coming down on this hard on Twitter. Also, J.D. Pritzker, governor of Illinois, because Chicago might be next, is also, you know, pointing out all these red states with horrible crime rates. So, yeah.
Well, there was news while we've been on the air that a California judge ruled today that President Trump's deployment... Hold on, now my phone went away. There we go. President Trump's deployment of the Guard to L.A. was illegal. So that was different circumstances than what he's doing in D.C., but...
Yeah, but
this will all be litigated, I guess.
Yeah, it's all going to be litigated. It all lands up in court. And, you know, you may have courts that come out with different things, which means then it's more likely to go to the U.S. Supreme Court. And if it goes to the U.S. Supreme Court, you know, you don't know what's going to happen. But the thing is that there's clearly an intention. We've heard it from the Trump administration that they intend to go into other areas. And the ones that keep getting mentioned are blue cities where the governors are coming out saying, we don't want you here. We don't need you here. Our crime rate's down and you have an ulterior motive for being here. So we're just kind of watching that play out.
All right. Well, we'll see if Cleveland, what was it, Cleveland, Toledo, or Dayton call for the National Guard. Just because the New York Times pointed it out, they're probably like, why not? Okay. Another story I wanted to touch on before we run out of time is there is a new Women in Law exhibit that has opened at the Ohio Supreme Court in the basement. Laura and Joe, you both covered this. Do one of you want to tell me what this exhibit is about and why it's in the basement?
So it's only 400 square feet. So it's actually kind of, I felt it was kind of small. I don't know.
It's about the size of your studio, I think.
Yeah, yeah. It's not very big. And so it's mostly because like student groups that are touring the Supreme Court enter through this ground level. And so it'll be a lot of students who look at it. And it's just a lot of pictures. There's a movie, just lots of history, like, you know, write-ups about women who, you know, were judges, early Supreme Court justices, that kind of thing. The thing that was kind of interesting about it wasn't what was there, but who was not there. At the ceremony, Maureen O'Connor, who is the first woman female justice, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, was not at the ceremony, and her name was absent when they were name-dropping people in the ceremony. And her official portrait, which had been in the Grand Concourse, which is the kind of grand hall that you walk down to get into the court chambers, her portrait had been there because she had been a lieutenant governor, and, you know, she did a lot of firsts for women. And it had been moved months ago before this exhibit even started construction on this exhibit. She had been moved down to this basement area. And so, she has been relegated to the basement. The League of Women Voters wanted a picture of the portrait in the basement exhibit and for her to stay in the Grand Concourse. There is no love lost between current Chief Justice Sharon Kennedy and Maureen O'Connor. They butted heads on a lot of things, and so she has been demoted to the basement.
All right. And do we, I mean, I'm assuming Maureen O'Connor was maybe invited to this
event.
She
was. Okay. I talked with the administrator of the court, and he said, yes, we invited her, and she declined. And I reached out to try to see if maybe former Chief Justice O'Connor wanted to talk about it. And her publicist said, nope, she really doesn't. So so that was kind of the end of that. But she wasn't there, and it was glaring to anyone who has any kind of knowledge about women in law. You're sitting there going, where is Maureen O'Connor?
Is this something that just school groups will see, or is this open to the public? Like, could I walk down there and go see it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. I'm just wondering if the basement was accessible. So
it is. I think it would be hard to get a large school group in there. You'd have to take them in, you know, a few at a time, because it is a small space.
Oh,
as Laura. I mean, it's like the size of a studio apartment.
Yeah. It's small.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We are having the last few minutes of our reporter roundtable. I did want to touch on, there's been talk of the presidential physical fitness test coming back to mixed reviews, and President Trump is doing that. But Lieutenant Governor Jim Tressel has his own fitness challenge, and he was kind of going around the state this past week with the first week of school. Can anyone fill us in on the details of what Lieutenant Governor Tressel wants for fitness for kids?
There's about 159,000 students who are signed up. It's voluntary, like schools choose whether to sign up or not. It does fit in with our state's PE requirements, like our PE standards, because, you know, the State Department of Education and Workforce has standards. And it's based on, you can do 10, 20, or 30 days. It's very permissive. So, you know, like with strength training, there might be like five different exercises and you pick one or two. It also emphasizes sleep and healthy eating habits. And Tressel plans to do it this semester, spring semester, and then next fall. And it's going to take President Trump a couple years to bring this back. And meantime, there's a bill in the legislature that would create the Ohio physical fitness test that would be based on the most recent iteration of the presidential test, which went away in 2012 under the Obama administration and got replaced by a program that's more like holistic, focusing on health, other kinds of health too.
And one last topic in the last 2 minutes we have. At one time, Ohio had the most bird flu cases in the country, and producers here in the state destroyed more than 15 million birds during this outbreak. But here we have Jim Shakiris, Executive Vice President of the Ohio Poultry Association, giving us an update.
So we're slowly coming back from that. At 35, 36 million laying hens, we're still the number two egg-producing state in the United States.
So basically, we're saying that we made it out of the bird flu. Is it done for for this year?
On that scale, yeah, for sure. There's like isolated cases, probably. Mm-hmm. But
the last case was in April. They depopulated or killed 15.5 million birds, and this was something I learned when I was reporting on it. Ohio is number two in egg production and poultry after Iowa. So this is actually a really important industry for our state.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, hopefully, I mean, you know, if we're out of the flu now, maybe we have preventative measures and it won't come back. We'll see. Right. Mm. All right. Well, this has been the Reporter Roundtable, and I wanted to thank our panel today. Joe Ingles, senior reporter for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Thanks, Joe.
Thanks for having me.
Laura Hancock, politics and policy reporter at Cleveland.com. Thanks, Laura.
Thank you.
And Megan Henry, reporter for the Ohio Capital Journal. Thanks, Megan.
Thank you.
And this has been the Reporter Roundtable on a special Tuesday edition from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.